Good morning, my sisters and brothers. How are you today? Besides a plenty. Man, there's a lot of us in here, isn't there? Wow. Starting to smell like a junior high kind of function. Somebody actually said, hey. I tried to disguise that. Glad you're here. The ushers are going to come forward. If you came prepared to financially participate in what God is doing through this little community of ours, what he does locally, what he does globally through our continued uniting, our oneness, our faith, our trust, our confidence in who he is. If you're prepared to do that, then that's what the next few moments are going to be about with the funny bag with handles going by. We're continuing a series. We're in, like, I think it's week four, things I keep, things I'm responsible for. I heard somebody filled in last week, Andy something. I heard that message was, Actually, it was a great, great message, and it's really good stuff. I hope that if you were here, that you're benefiting from that still. But we're gonna take this series a little bit further. I actually just got back a few days ago. Me and my wife and my three young children were blessed with the opportunity to take a first ever trip to Disney, and apparently you all bow at the feet of the mouse. So, it was just, there's so many stories. Like, I'm going to try to find a way to tell some of the cool stories that happened. You know, three consecutive days in the parks, and just all the fantastic. I mean, my son thinks he's a Jedi. Yeah, he went through the Star Wars thing. He was already kind of on the fence. Like, I think I might have power of the Force, Dad. You know, and so, you know, like the other day, I tied a fishing string to his lightsaber, and I was like, stick your hand out. And he does this, and I pull it, and he's like, oh. It's like, that's right. And but that's probably bad parenting. just a fascinating thing, and there's all kinds of stories to tell about being there. But one of the things that's funny is Disney World is, quote, the happiest place on earth. And being in Orlando in mid-August with a few million others, I called into question that logo, that slogan, a couple of times. I was telling Jonathan this. I have seen in the last week more parents lose their minds with their kids than cumulatively the previous 10 years. Like, when you get there in the morning, everybody's got on their little Mickey ears and their shirts and their face paint, and it's Mickey Mouse, and they're, yay, and we all go, and there's the castle. But by 2 p.m., there's a major shift in the mood because it's 115 degrees. And Pluto is completely unavailable for pictures. And what I was noticing, I honestly saw this so many times, my wife and I saw this so many times, that we began to laugh. It's not funny, but we began to laugh because we kept seeing parents who apparently have in their mind, we spent a lot of money. You will enjoy this. And they grab, like, these young children are like, I'm hot, I don't care anymore, I want to go, oh no, you will. And so there's a spot. If you're a parent, you know. If you're not a parent, you don't understand. But there's a spot on a 5, 6, 7-year-old. It's like a hand. The humerus is a handle to the whole body. And so parents grabbing the humerus handle, and there's a language you learn to speak when you're a parent. If you're not a parent, you don't know this unless you remember your parents. It's unintelligible to everybody else around, but the kid understands it when you grab the handle because it goes like this. And I heard the secret parent language and the secret humorous handle hold so many times, anytime from lunch on. And every time I didn't do this. I really wish I had done it at least once. I had the urge to do it. But every time I would see it, because I hover above that kind of behavior. I don't, you know. Every time I would see it, I would think to myself, happiest place on earth. It was fun. There's a lot of good stories that came from it, and we were blessed to get to go and do all of that, and I'll share more stories another time. But it's got me thinking about happiness. I've thought a lot about happiness over the years, and I've come to some conclusions, and then I'm not finished. I don't have conclusions in some areas. I'm young in every sense of the word, and so I got some life to live. But I've thought a lot about happiness, and I've come to some conclusions that the pursuit of happiness, generally speaking, helps you acquire exactly the opposite. The pursuit of happiness is exactly not that. that pursuing happiness, that going after happiness, is a very foolish thing to do. And I've come to the conclusion, and I know that you'll disagree with me, and I know on what grounds, and some of you have said, but you don't understand my circumstances because X, Y, and Z happened or is happening. I know what I mean. I know what I don't mean. I know all of the push. I get that. But I've come to the conclusion, we're already happy. We're already fulfilled. We're already satisfied. We're already blessed. That the baseline of humanity is happiness. You're already happy. The problem is our addictions, our attractions, our impulses, our longings, all the distractions that we pile on top of the happiness that we are. You're made in the image of the God of the universe. Your base mode is happiness. You're already happy. It's all the things we've put on top of it that shield our hearts from knowing that we already have what we're pursuing. And to pursue happiness actually nets you the very opposite. To go after, and how do you achieve happiness? You already are. I already know you could tell your story and we would all say, oh, wow, that's, you know, maybe Steve's wrong. But I've come to the conclusion after talking to lots of people and looking within my own life that if you want happiness, then you have to let go of expecting to find it outside of your life and in somebody else's. So today, we're going to be talking about this one thing and what it means to, you know, when you get to the end of your life and you say there were certain responsibilities. I had all these menial tasks and other things that I was responsible for, but there were major ways of looking at my responsibilities that at the end of my life, I'm going to look back and say those were the most important. Today, I want to step into that for a fourth time in this series. And so I'm going to be talking about this one thing, but the whole time, I'm talking about being happy. And if happiness is your goal, you'll never get it. I'm talking about fulfillment. I'm talking about satisfaction and what it means to be blessed. And I want you to know that that's what your Father in heaven wants for you. He doesn't want you to be religious. Most of the Bible is toward religious people. Hey, religious people, chill, shut up, get out of my way. Most of the Bible is exactly that. God wants you to be happy, not in the flaky, superficial thing that we call happy. This, you know, these moments, these fleeting moments of an emotion. No. Fulfilled, whole, satisfied, happy. Psalm 37, verse 4. Delight yourself in the Lord. See, Lord is in all caps. That means in the Hebrew, that's his name, Yahweh, that the great I am, the self-existent one. I will be what I will be is my name. Delight yourself in him, and he'll give you the desires of your heart. I guarantee most of us grew up, if we grew up around religion, don't think that you're allowed to believe Psalm 37, verse 4. He'll give you the desires of your heart. You better believe in committing yourself. See the next line, commit your way to Yahweh, trust in him, and he will act. You better believe that what you want now, before having taken your delight in committing yourself to God, that what you want now will be different. Just like when I was 9, what I wanted and thought was important is a lot different decades later. Delight yourself in Yahweh, and he'll give you the desires of your heart. Do you know what that means? He wants you to be happy. Son, daughter, he wants you to have satisfaction. Jesus comes, John 10:10, and says, I have come that you can have the best life possible. The thief comes to steal and kill and destroy. I want you to have an abundant, full, satisfying, happy, fulfilling life. That's what your God wants. So we're talking about happiness in a way today. So to begin, I'd like for you to turn to the book of John. It's the fourth book in the New Testament, the fourth gospel, the book of John, and we're going to be in the 21st chapter. Jesus has been, after his teaching, his ministry, his life, he's crucified. He dies on a cross, taken off the cross, buried, resurrects. There's rumors. I think I saw Jesus alive. I did. I touched him. I talked to him, and it's now verifiable. Jesus was dead, and now he's not, and he's never going to be dead again, and he's still inviting us into this life, starting now and lasting forever. And Jesus walks up on a beach and calls the disciples onto the beach from a boat, and they all swim ashore and they have a fish breakfast, which I can't imagine being a blessing, but it was for them. And so they're having this fish breakfast, and John chapter 21, verse 15 says, when they'd finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, stop, this is the Simon Peter. Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? That these could be the fish, it could be the disciples, any of the other onlookers, the boats they're fishing. It doesn't matter. Simon, do you love me more than anything else? Are you focused and committed on who I am? Now, you got to remember that just a few sentences earlier, days before, Peter said, I'll never leave you, Jesus, but to save his own rear end, denied having ever met Jesus three times. Remember that? Before the rooster crows? I don't know him, I don't know him, I don't know him. And now, so there's been an elephant in the room, a camel, in the room the whole time during breakfast. Are we going to deal with what Peter did? Simon, son of John, do you love me more than anything else? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said to him, feed my lambs. Who feeds lambs? Shepherds. What are shepherds? People that are responsible for a very well-defined thing. Feed my lambs, Peter. You love me? Here's your responsibility. He said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter replies, yes, Lord. Next slide. You know that I love you. He said to him, tend my sheep. This is your responsibility. He said to him the third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And Peter was grieved because he said to him a third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, Master, you know everything. You know that I love you. Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and go wherever you wanted. But when you're old, you're going to stretch out your hands. Another is going to dress you and carry you where you do not want to go. This he said to show by what kind of death Peter was going to glorify God. And after saying this, he said to him, follow me. Now, when he met Peter 3 years earlier, these are the first words he said to Peter, follow me. And now he's saying, follow me again. Peter has denied Christ. Jesus steps into some reconciliation. He says, Peter, what I want you to do, you're forgiven, but that's not just a word. I want you to perpetuate my ministry. Everything I've taught you, everything I've been to you, I want you to take my spot, and I want you to lead these guys. Shepherd the sheep. Feed the lambs. You love me? You in? That's what I want you to do. Here's your responsibility. This is Peter. Take on and perpetuate my teachings, my life, and my ministry. Get the church started, Peter. This is your responsibility. Maybe it's lost on you. This is a deeply significant moment that would reverberate for 2,000 years. Peter, you are Simon Peter. Here is the ministry I am placing on. This is the responsibility I am giving to you. And now, Peter, when you're young, you could do what you wanted, but you're going to do what I want now, and it's going to lead to your death. And Peter, at the end of his life, is crucified, but in this last minute says, I don't want to be crucified the way my Lord was. I'm not worthy to be killed in that manner. You put me upside down, feet up, and they did it, and they nailed his feet where the head goes, and Peter was killed upside down on a crucifix, on a Roman crucifix. This is Simon Peter being commissioned to be Simon Peter, to perpetuate the life, spirit, ministry of Jesus and to catalyze the church. And here's the next sentence. Verse 20, Peter turned, having that conversation, Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following them. This is how the author of John refers to himself. I love this. John was just, it didn't take up enough ink apparently. So just Jesus's favorite. Peter turns and sees the disciple whom Jesus loved following them. The one who'd been reclining at the table close to him nights earlier and said, Lord, who is it that's going to betray you? Remember, they're sitting at the Last Supper. Who is it that's going to betray you? John is saying, yeah, that was me. And Peter sees me. And when Peter saw him, and he's taking a narrator's position. When Peter saw him, he said to Jesus, Lord, what about him? He's just been commissioned to be Simon Peter. Here comes John. Yeah, but what about him? Jesus said to him, if it's my will that he remains until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. Peter, haven't you been listening to? I just gave you your responsibilities. If I want him to live until the second coming, what does that have to do with you? You follow me. Yeah, but what about him? What about her? What about them? What about that family? What about that company? What about that church? What about No. What do they, he, she, have to do with you? You follow me. There's a terribly, terribly unhappy life being lived by all those who don't realize how often they ask that question. What about him? What about her? Proverbs chapter 14, verse 30. A tranquil heart, the word tranquil in Hebrew is most times translated in English, healed, healthy, or whole. A lot of times you'll see that word put up against brokenness. It's the opposite of a broken person. A tranquil, whole, healthy, healed heart gives life to the flesh. When who you are is solid and whole. We talk about wholeness a lot. Shalom. Shalom, peace. A whole, healthy heart gives life to the flesh, but envy makes the bones rot. Envy gets all the way down into who you are and rots your frame, rots you at your core. And some of us in this room know exactly how that feels, to have your insides rotting, to have the core of who you are off and weakened and rotten. James is arguably the earliest New Testament document. James is the brother of Jesus, and he's writing to brand new followers of Jesus, brand new Christians. And in chapter 4, he says this: what causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions, your desires, your weak lusts are at war within you? You desire, you covet, you envy, and do not have, so you murder. Now, a lot of us, we're like, whew, okay, I'm off the hook. I've never murdered. Jesus says, if you carry anger towards somebody, you idiot, you know what you did to me. Do you know how stupid you are? And when you carry that, that's murder for Jesus. We can't pride ourselves in not producing a corpse. You desire and you don't get, so you kill. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You don't have because you don't ask. You ask and you don't receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. God, I want what she has. God, I've worked way harder than him. You owe me because he... You adulterous people. This is James writing a letter to his friends. And this next sentence goes into calling you an adulterer. An adulteress. Why? Because you're made to live your life in the image of your Creator, and your baseline is fulfillment and wholeness and happiness and satisfaction. And every time you say, nope, can't be found here, I'm going to veer this way, I'm going to take a bite of this fruit, I'm going to go this way, it's like having another relationship. You adulterer, you adulteress. Don't you know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Now, God so loved the world that he gave his only son, John 3:16. This isn't about living in a commune and not having any contact with the outside world. This is, you're playing their game. Friendship with the world, you're linking arms with them and playing that game, and you're making yourself an enemy of wholeness and life and beauty. You adulterer. It's a toxin. Yeah, but James, what about him? Do you see them, what they have? What is that to do with you? You follow me. You follow Jesus. You fix your eyes and you focus and delight in the Lord. There's a terribly, terribly unhappy life to be lived by rating and comparing and evaluating your whole existence up against somebody else and going, yeah, but what about? See, when a kid is born, their delight naturally is in their parents. Everything you need and a lot of what you want when you're first born comes from your parents. Ideally, that's where your life comes from. Your delights are there. As you grow up, siblings or other neighborhood kids come into the picture, and what was totally fine now vertically now becomes a feud, a war. Hey, his has a kung fu grip. Mine was fine, but now she's got the pink one, and why does he get two scoops? And they get to stay out until, and how come, and what was totally fine, content, and satisfactory now becomes broken. And it's envy, and it's comparison, and it's coveting and longing, and it's toxic, and it rots the bones. your happiness gets overshadowed by this ongoing preoccupation with other people's life. And wanting to have what they have, wanting to be what they are, wanting to experience what they're experiencing, wanting to be included in what they're doing, wanting to be seen how they're seen, wanting their life is a way of telling God, you're blowing it. You owe me. And you cannot at the same time have an attitude that you are being shorted, that you should have, that you want, that you're entitled to something that somebody else has, and at the same time have gratitude. Do your best impression later of being grumpy and then say thanks. It'll come out sarcastic. You can't mean it. You can't do this. You can't be thankful. And if you're not thankful, guess what? You're not happy, fulfilled, content. They're mutually exclusive. You can't do both. And it rots the bones. Envy rots the bones. It affects my ability to love you. How can I love you and give to you when you should be given to me? How do I receive love from you when you're obviously already above me in value, and so I've got to humble myself even lower and receive from you? I'm not playing that game. It gives you more power. It messes with all your relationships. It messes with your ability to see yourself the way that God sees you. So it can be stuff, achievement, position, things that you've done, things that you have, your looks, your views, your fame. It can be tangible or intangible. But many of us are completely unaware, because we've never asked the question, what about him or what about her? It's more subtle. We're completely unaware. We've created our own hell. Because you cannot be the person you were made to be and take responsibility for what you've been given responsibility for if you're trying to live somebody else's life, longing to live somebody else's life, wishing you were responsible for what they're responsible for. Now other people are to be envied, not loved, envied. They possess what you should have. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and everything will be added to you, everything that you need. See, Jesus says this in Matthew 6. He says, you want to be my followers? Don't be anxious. See all the Gentiles that don't know who God is? They're worried about, what am I going to wear? What am I going to eat? What am I going to drink? He says, don't do that. Don't do that. You seek first the kingdom. Don't go after those things. God, if you seek the kingdom first, if you delight yourself in the Lord, you focus on who God is. You know, what's that got to do with you? You follow me. You do that. Everything you need and a lot of what you want is going to be given to you. Don't live that way. But when you live in envy, you're not asking, can I get what Jesus has in his kingdom? You're asking, can I get what's in hers and his and theirs? I'm going to go, I want what they have. And you become, rather than the first-rate version of yourself that God intended for you to be, you become a second-rate version of somebody else. That is not the life that your Father in heaven wants you to have. That's hell. It's a terrible, terrible, unhappy way to live. What about them? What about them? What about them? So what I've noticed is in talking to people, and the last thing I want to do is make people cautious of using certain words. But if you pay attention, the words that we choose often reveal bigger realities inside. And I've begun to notice over the years the ways that people talk about themselves, about their own life, their own existence. And one of the key words that I hear is just. I've got an iPhone. I'm kind of an Apple fan, and so I have an iPhone, and I was asking somebody a few weeks ago for their phone number, and we were just going to do the let's trade the numbers with the phones thing real quick, and they pull their phone out, and they said, I just have a flip phone. Like I was saying, what's that? I totally uninvited. They said, I just have a flip phone. 10 seconds earlier, it was a phone. But now it's just a flip phone. Why? Because they're comparing. On some level, maybe they're saying, I wish I had that. On another, they're saying, I recognize fully that yours is better than mine. Mine's just this. I just have a ranch home. My address, you're coming over. Oh, just FYI, it's just a townhome. It's an apartment. I'll pick you up at 6. By the way, it's just a hatchback. It's just a minivan, French fries in the seats. Here's one I hear a ton. And it's equal parts funny and it grieves me. What do you do? Oh, I'm just a stay-at-home mom. Grieves me. I'm just. See, everybody else is having a really significant, impactful life. Me, I'm stuck raising humans. I'm just a mom. I hear people talk about their church this way. I hear pastors talk about their church this way. Oh, you go to Crosspoint? Yeah, I'm one of the pastors there. Oh, awesome. Where do you pastor? Oh, I'm such and such. It's just a church of like 200, 250. Oh, yeah, God just doesn't even go there. He doesn't like them. Not enough people. Minimum 1,000 in attendance for God to even pay attention. I wouldn't even bother praying. He's not listening. What are you talking about? Just a church of 250. What? I go to a church, it's in so-and-so. It's a smaller church. It's just a church, a couple hundred. What? See, I want you to understand. No, I want you to do more than understand. If you'll embrace this sentence, it really can change so many things for you. Not least of which would be your level of satisfaction with your own existence. And it's this. Comparison is the nemesis of contentment. You cannot be making comparisons. What about him? What about her? What about them? What about... As the leader of an organization, as a member of a family, of a household, as an individual, you cannot at the same time be asking, oh, man, I wish we had their bottom line. Man, I wish I had that car. Man, I wish I had her body. You can't do that and at the same time be thanking God. You can't be content. And that's a terrible, terrible way to live, if it's living at all. Comparison is the enemy of contentment. There's a couple ways that this plays out, and I read this article this past week. And it blew my mind. This guy, Robert Frank, he's an economist at Cornell. He did a survey, I think a few years ago. And this is what his survey found. Most Americans, if given a choice between two scenarios, would choose to earn $100,000 a year while everybody else earns $85,000 a year, rather than earning $110,000 a year, where everybody else makes $200,000 a year. You catch that? I would rather make $10,000 less if it puts me in $15,000 superiority to everybody else. I would not want the extra $10,000 if it puts me as inferior $90,000 to everybody else. So the amount of money is totally fine until you add somebody else, and then this primal, dark, broken thing comes out of us. What about them? Which side of envy will I be on? Will I be envious or will I be envied? Because my contentment is based on the answer to that, and it rots the bones. He said the survey reflects most Americans feel that way. They don't even realize that this is playing in the background. When you're able to compare with somebody else, it changes the values. What was just fine has now, it's now got less worth. Because what about him? What about her? What about what she has or is? What about what he has or is experiencing, is included in? What about them? And Jesus says, what does that have to do with you? I want you to live your life. I want you to be responsible for what you're responsible for. You follow me. This is something God's been trying to get across to us for thousands of years before Jesus said this. For thousands of years, since the very beginning, God has been trying to get you to focus on him and not swerve to the right or left. To focus on him and delight in him. When Israel, they're slaves in Egypt and they're brought out of Egypt and they're given the commands, we find in Deuteronomy chapter 5, he says, I am the Lord your God. I am Yahweh Elohim who've brought you out of Egyptian slavery. I'm giving you your life back. You want fulfillment, satisfaction, happiness? It comes through belonging to me. You're no longer slaves. You are mine. My name is on you. Your name is on me. We carry each other's reputations. I am the Lord your God who brings you out of Egyptian slavery. And then he gives the first command. There's 10 commands, the Devarim, the 10 words. There's 613 total commands, but there's this top 10 that reflects the character of all of the commands. And the first commandment, after he says, I am the Lord your God that brought you out of Egyptian slavery, is this in verse 7. You shall have no other gods before me. Would have been really helpful if he'd have said, there is no such thing as other gods. But he does not say that. And that should alert us. You can give the title God to all sorts of things. Ideas, things you chisel, people, you. You will have no other gods before me. This is the first commandment. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and then you get to 10, verse 21 that reads this way. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not set your desire on your neighbor's house or his land, his manservant or maidservant, the guy that does his landscaping, the nanny, the cleaning lady, his ox, his donkey, his Corvette, his Vespa, anything that belongs to your neighbor. Do not covet. Do not long after that. Don't be envious of their situation. All of the other nine have to do with actions that other people could go, look, he's doing it, or look, he's not doing it. You can metric them. You can point to them. You can measure them. How do you measure envy? If you kill somebody, I can go, look, you just killed somebody. Do not murder. Do not steal. You just took his wallet. How do you metric, measure, and observe envy? Covetousness. Can't, really. Not until it becomes an action, which is something else. The 10th commandment deals with the inner world. It's the only one that deals with your inner world. So there's some ancient philosophers that came up with some of this, and the first time I heard it was 5 or 6 years ago. Rob Bell, he's a pastor up in Michigan. I totally stole this idea from him. That the reason that the 10th commandment is what it is that it's an observation. It's a commandment, but it's really an observation or even a reward. Chris, if you could put it back up there. The first commandment is, you will have no other gods but me. If you get that one right, then all of the other ones make perfect sense. And the 10th one is the reward. That you will get to walk into your day-to-day life not coveting your neighbor's wife or husband. You're not going to set your desire on your neighbor's house or land. His manservant, maidservant, his ox, his donkey, his stuff, the people he relates with, his influence. If you get the first one right, there's this huge blessing that comes. You want to know what the reward is? You'll live your life. You'll be satisfied with your life. You'll be happy with what you're responsible for. You won't walk around going, I wish I had her responsibilities. Oh, my life is so, if I only could do what he. Now, that's hell. If you get the first one right, the 10th one is an observation. You will not envy. You will not covet. You will live your life fixated on the person of Jesus and nobody else. See, the blessing, the satisfaction, the fulfillment, the happiness is discovered. Not by going and achieving what somebody else has done, but by focusing our hearts and our eyes on the person of Christ. When I realize that what I'm responsible for is what I'm responsible for, and that I can't find any sort of life in trying to be responsible for what you're responsible for having and being and doing what she does, he does, they do. I can't find life in that. My job is not to worry about them, but to worry about what I'm supposed to worry about. Take responsibility for my own life, however grand, however mundane. And this says nothing about improvement or personal growth or achievement in general. Those are not evil things. This says nothing about those things being evil. What it does say is that refusing to live the life God has given you and stepping into the life that God has given you specifically right now, refusing to do that is telling God, you owe me better. I want his stuff. I want her stuff. That's what I'm saying it is. It's impossible to live the life that God has given somebody else to live. You at best will be a second-rate version of somebody else. You'll be a knockoff, and that's not what your Father in heaven has for you. And so to the mother of toddlers, the young girl that's single and doesn't have any kids and can write things down that I'm going to do this tonight at 6 o'clock and then goes and does it. That's her life. Your life is a sacred, sacred thing before God. And the whole world is telling you you should have her life and her skin and her sleep schedule and her social life, and you should be dissatisfied, and you're going to get the urge to say, I'm just, but I want you to know that your Father in heaven looks at that and says, it's a holy, holy, sacred thing that you're doing right now, and you do your life. What's she got to do with you? Focus on me. And listen, this is not stop complaining and just fold the socks. That's a different sermon. This is your Father in heaven saying, my dear, dear sisters, what you have is your responsibility. And you're missing out only to the extent that you're looking and comparing your life to somebody else. To the man that's been in middle management for years. And every time he tries to put his foot on the rung, it breaks. He can't move up. She did, and apparently he's related to the boss because he's an idiot and moved up in a month, has the corner office. I've been here for years. I'm stuck here. That bitterness, that envy, that lust after somebody else's life, what does he, she, them have to do with you? You work as though working for the Lord, and do this well. What do they have to do? You follow me, Jesus is saying to you. This isn't merely you stop complaining. You pretend to like things that are unlikable. It's stop comparing and learn the secret of contentment. Because God is never going to give you somebody else's life. Trust me, it's the last thing you actually want. To the recent high school graduate, watching his friends get scholarships, full rides, their parents have more money, whatever it is. And if you get to go to college, it's going to be some community college. You do that well, as though educating your beautiful mind for the Lord. That is your story in you. There is no just. There is no, that is who you forget them. You fix your eyes on Christ and delight yourself in who he is, and you live your story. Parents that have kids that aren't, you don't feel like you can brag on them. They've made a bunch of bad choices. They're difficult. They're whatever. Man, those kids, not only are they dressed really, really well, but man, they're superstars. They do this, the trophies, the scholarship. Your children are your responsibility. You are not to long after having responsibility for somebody else's kids, somebody else's life. Your children are your responsibility. And that's a sacred, sacred, holy thing. As a couple, you might think, well, our life is kind of boring. I wish our life had all the pizzazz that other people's life has. I mean, maybe we should do this, and they always get to do this. And you live your life. My faith isn't very dynamic. I grew up in the church. I don't have any big, cool stories to share. No, you know, miraculous 180 that I did. And, you know, I used to be, you know, Gestapo, and now I'm, you know, I go to church. And, you know, you live your faith. What does he, she, their story have to do with you? You follow me, your Jesus says to you. We need to be very, very, very careful. Because what the world insists is mundane, meaningless, stalled, boring, less valuable, what the world deems as any of those kinds of things, God Almighty might deem worship. What you want out of, what you think isn't valuable, what's less than, what's just, God might call worship. So I want to close in the book of Romans, chapter 12, Eugene Peterson's paraphrase of the Message translation of Romans 12. And what I would like for you to do is not follow along in your Bibles, but realize that this is to you. This is from Paul, inspired as he was by God's animating spirit to tell each and every one of us the truth. So maybe you want to close your eyes and listen, because some of you know that this is hitting very specific. Some of it is just a general, I needed to be reminded of that. But I want you to hear Paul's words to the Romans, to you. Here's what I want you to do, God helping you. Take your everyday, ordinary life, your sleeping, eating, going to work, and walking around life, and place it before God as an offering. Embracing what God does for you is the best thing you can do for Him. Don't become so well adjusted to your culture that you fit into it without even thinking. Instead, fix your attention on God. You'll be changed from the inside out. Readily recognize what He wants from you and quickly respond to it. Unlike the culture around you, always dragging you down to its level of immaturity, God brings the best out of you, develops well-formed maturity in you. I'm speaking to you out of deep gratitude for all that God has given me, and especially as I have responsibilities in relation to you. Living then, as every one of you does, in pure grace, it's important that you not misinterpret yourselves as people who are bringing this goodness to God. No, God brings it all to you. The only accurate way to understand ourselves is by what God is and by what He does for us, not by what we are and what we do for Him. In this way, we're like the various parts of a human body. Each part gets its meaning from the body as a whole, not the other way around. The body we're talking about is Christ's body of chosen people. Each of us finds our meaning and function as a part of His body. But as a chopped off finger or cut off toe, we wouldn't amount to much, would we? So, since we find ourselves fashioned into all these excellently formed and marvelously functioning parts in Christ's body, let's just go ahead and be what we're made to be without enviously or pridefully comparing ourselves with each other or trying to be something we are not. If you preach, just preach God's message, nothing else. If you help, just help. Don't take over. If you teach, stick to your teaching. If you give encouraging guidance, be careful that you don't get bossy. If you're put in charge, don't manipulate. If you're called to give aid to people in distress, keep your eyes open and be quick to respond. If you work with the disadvantaged, don't let yourself get irritated with them or depressed by them. Keep a smile on your face. For love from the center of who you are, don't fake it. And run for dear life from evil. Hold on for dear life to good. Be good friends who love deeply. And practice playing second fiddle.